This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, October 20th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. In the first 10 months of the administration, 10 members of Trump's inner circle have resigned. The president has attacked Republican congressional leaders Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and humiliated Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson had to deny claims that he had called the president a moron. 2 weeks ago, Bob Corker, the retiring Republican senator from Tennessee, told The Times, "I know for a fact that every single day at the White House, it's a situation of trying to contain him." On Monday, John McCain lashed out against the half-baked, spurious nationalism currently guiding the country. Yesterday, former President George W. Bush said, "Bigotry seems emboldened. Our politics seem more vulnerable to conspiracy theories and outright fabrication." Through it all, Vice President Mike Pence has remained steadfast. In June, at the start of Trump's first full cabinet meeting, he asked everyone to go around and introduce him and herself with a short statement. Pence spoke first.
"Thank you, Mr. President, and just the greatest privilege of my life is to serve as Vice President to a president who's keeping his word to the American people and assembling a team that's bringing real change, real prosperity, real strength back to our nation."
Jane Mayer discusses the political path that led Mike Pence to the White House, the role he is playing as vice president, and his plans for the near future. Jane, welcome.
Great to be with you.
I want to talk about the piece that you published in The New Yorker this past week. Pence and Trump seem in many ways like an odd couple, yet you quote one of Trump's pollsters telling you that the president considers him one of the best decisions he's made. Why is that?
For one thing, Pence is among the only senior officials inside the White House who has not feuded with Trump. His approach to Trump is to be tremendously, at least outwardly, loyal and almost fawning.
I was surprised by a number of things in your portrait of Pence. I'm curious about what surprised you.
I think what most people knew about Pence, and at least what I had known about him in advance, is you have this image that he kind of defines the far right on social issues. He's a born-again Christian, and he has been the voice of kind of opposition to the legalization of abortion and kind of a staunch opponent of gay rights over the years. So I expected to see that. But what I found is, and of course that is all true, but there's another dimension to him that I hadn't realized, which is he's tremendously ambitious.
Yes.
And has been for years. And in fact, I quote the editor of the local newspaper in the town that Pence grew up in, Columbus, Indiana, saying that it appears that when he popped out of the womb, he was planning to run for president and has been trying almost ever since. And in fact, told a number of his high school classmates that he was planning to be president or hoping to be so. So he's had his eye on this for a very long time. There's an aspect of him that is willing to wheel and deal and do the kinds of things people do to get ahead. It's somewhat at war with this idea of him as an uncompromising zealot.
You're talking about one of the things that struck me, which is he, in earlier incarnations, he presented quite a different face to the public.
He was one of the early adapters to the Tea Party, and he had a pretty angry edge at that particular period in his life. You can see him still on YouTube with a group of Tea Party, very rowdy protesters, and Pence is there shouting, "Shut it down." And he's talking about shutting down the whole United States government unless Planned Parenthood is defunded. So there is a kind of an angry edge to him at some points.
And what was his tenure in Congress like? Did he get any major legislation passed?
He got no legislation passed that he authored himself, absolutely not a single bill. He was really focused, according to the people I interviewed, on his national image. He really, again, seems to have had his eye on the presidency and on becoming a national figure. And so he spent a lot of his time on the sort of banquet circuit, giving speeches to conservative groups, the NRA and the Heritage Foundation and other kind of national organizations, and traveling to states that have important primaries in the presidential election, such as, New Hampshire and Iowa.
That whole libertarian streak that is also very much who he is. Talk a little bit about that and how and when he got close to Charles and David Koch and the corporate wing of the party.
So this was actually, even though I've written this book, Dark Money, that's about the Koch brothers and other sort of billionaire influencers, I had not realized till I started researching the story on Pence the extent to which he was tied to the Kochs and vice versa. He is really, truly their favorite politician, and they have sponsored his career.
Starting when?
Starting really quite early, if you go back to some of the institutions that the Kochs and other sort of billionaire funders on the right had built. Basically, Pence ran for Congress twice unsuccessfully in 1988 and 1990. And he bombed out, and he was pretty in a not a great position in life at that point. He had a law degree, but he had a very minor legal career, and he didn't really like practicing law that much, his brother told me. And he didn't have much money. At that point, a lifeline was thrown him by a state think tank in Indiana that was just starting up, and it's called the Indiana Policy Institute. And it was funded in part by the Heritage Foundation, the big right-wing think tank in Washington, which itself was funded by the Kochs and other big billionaire right-wing donors. So he gets a perch in this kind of machinery that is funded by right-wing business interests and billionaire interests. They sort of throw him a lifeline and give him a job and a steady paycheck and acquaint him with the whole sort of ideological worldview that they have, that sort of far-right libertarian, free market thinking, anti-government, anti-tax, anti-regulation, and he adapts really well to it. He had actually been a Democrat from a Democratic family and had voted for Jimmy Carter.
Was he attracted by Carter's evangelical beliefs?
Probably. I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, I should say right up front here that unfortunately Mike Pence declined to give me an interview despite many requests, and that was a shame. But I felt very lucky to be able to talk to both his mother and his brother.
That was one of the most interesting parts of the piece. For one thing, they're a very engaging family, and they're all quite funny.
I really enjoyed them, I have to say. And who knew that Mike Pence had a charming and funny mom? She had a family of six kids, and her oldest son, Gregory, also joined the interview, and he was quite funny. And the two of them just sort of riffed and ribbed each other about
the family. And he was quite frank about his brother, too.
He was. I mean, I think he was, any of us who have siblings might recognize it as, an older brother who's not going to let anybody else going to get away with just being the saint of the family. And so the mother would say, well, he was of Mike Pence, he was a wonderful student. Mike's older brother would say, well, he wasn't that good a student, And the mother would say, he's driven by service. And the brother would say, and by popularity and ambition. And, so they were kind of, just poking fun at each other and poking, and the brother was poking a little bit of fun at Pence. So I should also say he really admires his brother a lot, too.
And is that the brother who's just announced that he's going to run for Congress?
He is actually running for Congress from the district that includes Columbus, Indiana. Gregory Pence, from my limited exposure to him, we had coffee and then we had an off-the-record lunch together. I would say he's very charming, and he certainly got the name recognition there.
So when Pence was named vice president, he was nearing the end of his first term as governor of Indiana. But by then, his approval ratings had fallen, and his chances of winning a second term didn't seem so promising. What went wrong there?
Well, this is another thing that was a surprise to me. I guess I had heard rumors that when Pence was chosen as vice president, people sort of murmured about how he might not have even gotten reelected as governor of Indiana. But it wasn't until I got to Indiana and interviewed a lot of people, and in particular a lot of Republicans there, that I realized truly how unpopular Mike Pence was as governor of Indiana. Many, many people told me they thought he couldn't have gotten reelected, and for very interesting reasons. If you consider him as a potential president, which is he was so far right, and he pushed in such extreme directions on social issues, particularly anti-abortion and anti-homosexual issues, that he really alienated the state. He alienated even moderate Republicans and the Republican business community, which was up in arms over one particular bill, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Pence portrayed it to people as a bill that would safeguard religious freedom, which of course sounds like a really good thing. But in fact, what it meant when people took a closer look at it was that businesses that claimed for religious reasons that they didn't want to serve homosexuals would have been allowed to do that. So it legalized discrimination against homosexuals.
And remind us how Pence came to be the vice presidential nominee.
So there was a backstory here that I had never known either, which was he actually almost didn't get chosen. Trump, on the campaign, was really leaning towards picking Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, who had been an old friend of his and who he regarded as very loyal out on the campaign. But the people around Trump on the campaign, including Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, and Ivanka, his daughter, and a number of campaign aides, really didn't want to get Christie on the ticket. There was a lot of bad blood between Kushner and Christie, among other things. And so they really tried to push Trump into picking Pence, but Trump wasn't all that comfortable with it. And so what I discovered was that even after what was supposed to have been this special big meeting in Indianapolis between Trump and Pence to seal the deal, that night Trump was on the phone with Christie, sort of basically saying, are you ready? Are you ready to do this thing with me? And Christie was saying, which thing? And, you know, are you offering it? And Trump was saying, I'm asking. And are you ready? And so they were sort of like this flirtation that kept going. It's just really a crazy story. But I think Pence was almost a fluke. But he brought important things with him. He was an evangelical Christian who made the evangelical part of the Republican Party feel much more comfortable about backing Trump. And he also brought the Koch brothers and their enormous resources. And they didn't back the ticket at the time, but they have started backing Trump since.
There are very clear inroads he has been making in helping, for instance, to get certain officials into the administrations. So you want to talk a little bit about how the Koch agenda and the Pence agenda are one and the same?
This is based on reporting, talking to people in the transition period and, you know, about personnel in the Trump administration. And what a number of people said to me was that, you know, you have to remember, Trump's coming into government with no experience and very few relationships with people in politics, really. Pence, on the other hand, has been around Washington for years. So he had the connections, and he also was the chairman of the transition. So lo and behold, what starts happening is the government that is the Trump administration becomes just chock full of people with ties to the Kochs, who are very close and have been for years with Pence. So you see it in the cabinet, where you have somebody like Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education. She's been a backer of Pence. She's been a member of the Kochs' big donor club. You see somebody like Scott Pruitt, who becomes the head of the EPA, who is the dream candidate for the Kochs and is very close with Harold Hamm, who's a huge energy magnate in the fracking business. In Pence's office, it's just filled with people who've worked in the Koch operation. One of the people who's most important, the head of congressional liaison in the White House, Mark Short, was actually the head of the Koch's political operation, Freedom Partners, their big money operation. So, I mean, you can't have kind of a closer tie than that. Just since the story came out, actually, there's a new development, which is that Emily Seidel, who had worked also for Freedom Partners, which was the Koch's money operation, had gone to work for Pence, and she was working in the vice president's office. And just this week, she's been named the chief executive officer of Americans for Prosperity, which is the largest of the Koch's political groups, sort of on-the-ground grassroots groups. It's like a revolving door that is between the Kochs and Pence and the Trump White House. which is really kind of unexpected because if you go back and remember what happened during the campaign, Trump ran against the Kochs specifically.
It does feel as though the whole populist tenor of the campaign, which was that part of it was largely run by Steve Bannon, that it's sort of been jettisoned.
I personally think part of the way that Trump ran was by being a different kind of Republican, by being a populist Republican and running against big money, which he did. And he called the Kochs basically puppeteers and said that he was independent of these kinds of billionaire donors who he identified as corrupt. And I think that really, hit a nerve with many middle-class voters.
I've been wondering, in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal, we've seen that Trump's own sordid past has resurfaced. He's been accused by over 24 women of sexual harassment. His comments on the Access Hollywood tape just before the election almost caused the campaign to unravel. What was Pence's response to that at the time?
Well, this is sort of disputed territory. The people that I interviewed who were senior people inside the campaign, the Trump campaign, that is, said that it created terrible friction with Pence, who is, again, an evangelical Christian and very prim about these issues. And so, according to my sources, Pence's wife, in particular Karen, was horrified. And she and Pence wrote a letter that they sent to the campaign saying that they needed to assess their participation in it. And supposedly, Pence refused to take calls from Trump for a short period during the sort of the height of that scandal. But I got to say that the White House has pushed back hard on that, and Pence's office has, and they claim it's not so. There's very good sourcing on it, is all I can say. But it is, as I said, disputed territory here.
So talking about Pence's conscience, there was an extraordinary moment in November, right after the election, when he was attending a performance of Hamilton, and he was booed. And then he reportedly turned to his kids and said, "This is what freedom sounds like." What about that moment?
Well, and actually, I have to say, on behalf of Pence, he has been an unexpected supporter of press freedoms and kind of First Amendment freedoms. It may come out of the fact that for years he was a radio host. So he's been kind of part of the media for part of his career. He's in a different place from Trump on that, who seems to kind of, routinely slam the media.
Recently, on Trump's orders, he walked out of a football game in Indianapolis when members of the San Francisco 49ers were kneeling during the national anthem. So there are points where he will just do Trump's bidding, and then there are other points occasionally when he will stand up for what he believes.
Very rare, I have to say. And one of the questions I had when I plunged into this story was, if Trump were to do something really dangerous or try to, would Pence have the backbone to stop him? And I can't say I came away thinking he does. There are very, very few instances where you can see Pence standing up to Trump in any way. And one of the most important examples of that is that when Pence became the head of the transition, he let General Michael Flynn sort of walk into the door of the Trump administration and take a senior position in national security. And Chris Christie, who had run the transition before, had been blocking Flynn, who he saw as a danger and didn't trust. And he had warned many people against letting Flynn have any kind of national security position in the Trump administration. But Pence just kind of rolled over.
Well, and he then made some misleading statements about Flynn and that controversy.
He did. It's very hard to tell. If you look at it very closely, you can't tell if he was— he came out and he gave really misleading statements to the public about the whole Flynn episode and the sort of the early origins of the investigation into the any potential collusion with Russia. And you can't tell whether Pence himself, was misinformed and just kind of acting like a chump, or if he was actually overtly lying. There's one meeting he was in that makes it hard to believe that even he believed what he was saying, I have to say. It was a meeting in which the president talked about how he wanted to get rid of Comey, who was leading the investigation and then heading the FBI during that period. After the president did, in fact, fire Comey, and there was an uproar over it, Pence said the only reason that Trump had fired Comey was because the Justice Department had told him to. But yet Pence was in a meeting where they really planned to do it even before that. You know, either he's walking a very, very fine line or he's walking right past that line into the world of deception.
And did you get the sense that he is vulnerable in the Mueller investigation?
There are a number of law professors who think he might be in trouble. He's certainly hired a private lawyer now to represent him. And, you know, for want of a more technical term, Lawrence Tribe, the Harvard law professor, said that Pence is in what the legal profession calls deep doo-doo.
So in the end, Pence's fortunes are really tied to the success of the Trump presidency.
That is what many people think. And, you know, there's a good quote in the story from Ron Klain, who was chief of staff to Joe Biden when he was vice president. And Klain said, you know, that Pence may think he can run far enough and fast enough to get out from under Trump's shadow and become a major political figure and potentially president himself. But Klain says, I don't think he could do that.
Thanks so much, Jane.
Well, great to be with you.
Jane Mayer is a staff writer and the author of Dark Money, The Hidden History of Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. This podcast is produced by Jill Duboff for newyorker.com with help from Hannah Wilentz. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.